The Lord of the Rings Adventure Book Game, Escape Academy, and Kiri Eye, the Jewel. This is Staying In.
What are the rules on singing Happy Birthday these days? Because, Dan, it was your birthday.
It was my birthday.
And it is yet to be acknowledged.
But it's almost your birthday as well.
But it's almost my birthday as well. So that means that Chris would be the only one singing.
I will sing for you. No, Pete isn't actually here. He's just lost his voice, but he is just here. Bless him. He's turned up for the call, but, you know, he won't be able to speak.
Silent partner.
Yeah.
Him and I have decided to take every other word as we're singing.
Well, Pete's, to be fair, Pete's the one that who kind of always rails against the singing of the happy birthday.
Yes.
I like to
think that it's not because he's an enemy of fun, but more the case that he just doesn't want the attention.
Pete, in his own way, has killed it.
Yeah,
have
for
you
everyone.
Seen that, have you ever seen the stand-up thing that Trevor Noah does around singing Happy Birthday? And he tells this story about growing up in South Africa, and his mum always used to sing him the kind of the Donald Duck Happy Birthday song.
Right.
And he goes like lines of like, it's your birthday, it's Donald's birthday. It's like really upbeat. And he got really confused then when he went to school and everyone sings like this dirge of happy birthday. And you realise, actually, yeah, it is quite a somber song, the happy birthday song. And you never really, until you kind of compare it to other ways of singing happy birthday, it's like this really kind of dirge.
Yeah. But reading between the lines, it's like, another year towards death.
Yeah.
But that is why, much to my wife's chagrin, is I always harmonise at the end. Do I always get it right? No. But do I do it every single time? Oh, yes.
Because... Do you do it in spite of getting it wrong? Yes, absolutely.
I like to add a little coda at the end, which is, and many more.
Which is almost as threatening as... You're gonna die soon, and many more.
No,
maybe.
No. I think if I phrased it as a question, yeah, and many more.
Yeah. Are you sure you're gonna make it through to the next one?
Look at you.
I wouldn't be confident.
God, all that cake you're having right now.
Judgy.
You've had a good
happy
run.
Birthday. Did you have a nice birthday anyway, Dan?
I did have a lovely birthday. I had a lovely birthday. And then following that, you lovely gentlemen came down to see me this weekend just gone, which was an absolute delight.
Yeah, what a birthday treat. Me and you, Dan, did so much bowling.
I'm in pain. I've been in pain.
We both got injuries. I've not done so much bowling in my life in one sitting, and I never realized bowling could be such a aggressively physical sport.
Yeah,
but it turns out that doing, how many games did we do? We did three.
We played first. It was me and you, Sam. Chris, you weren't with us at this time. My wife was there, and then my six-year-old was also there, so there was four of us playing. So we all played one game. We paid for two games. We played through one, and then my wife took the kids to go into the arcade. So obviously we were left with another game to play, but four slots to fill. So obviously me and Sam filled two slots each, which means in each go you're bowling four balls in a row, which is quite energetic. And pretty much every single time we'd finish like one go and both of us would go to try and sit down and then be like, oh, I've got to go again. Ah.
Why were you bowling four in a row? Why didn't you decide to just do two, then two,
yeah,
then
we,
two?
We messed that up.
Well, we messed it up because one of them, which was the kind of the game allocated to my six-year-old, had the bumpers on the side. So I said, do you want to have the bumpers? And Sam immediately went, yes, I do. Yes, please. I'll have the one that on easy mode. But that, as a result, meant the way it fell was Sam, Dan, Dan. Sam, Dan, Dan. We should have rotated.
One thing I remember, I've not bowled in years, but the one thing I love is the really classic, goofy, 90s-esque animations you get on the screen above.
Yeah, I kind of railed against that. Like, one thing I noticed these days is bowling is now more of a nightclub than it is, settle down, there's sport going on here. Like, you know, it's like they forgot to turn on the entrance music and the lights from a darts match and have just said, right, that's it now. This is how we bowl. So
lots of neon.
Lots of neon, shots, lots of bright lights.
Black lights.
And it means what they've done is they've replaced the goofy animations with, I'm not sure if, I don't know if this is the same across all bowling lanes in the country, but now you can fully customize your score pad experience. So you can take like a group photo, which is like behind the scorecard, and then you can each take an individual photo of your face when it's for when it's your turn, so you can remember that it's you.
Right. Chris, only one of us decided to give themselves a kind of a profile picture, which was Sam. Me, my wife, and my six-year-old thought, no, that's rubbish. But Sam immediately jumped in there to personalise himself.
The only animations we got was when, after you'd done your first bowl, it then had an animation of what to then do on your second bowl, which I always thought was really patronising because Yeah. So it was kind of like, yeah, I know what I've got. I know what the aim of the game is. I know where I need to aim for. I'm just not that good, all right? Every single time I just knocked over some pins, it's like, yeah, you need to do this next turn. And it's like, I know.
If I was an alien and I landed on Earth, the one sport that I think is really kind of obvious in terms of how you play it is bowling.
Yeah, true. But then I think you would be equally confused about the sanctity of bowling, which we got to witness when we were playing, because one of the sides, one of the bumpers didn't fully pop up, didn't proper fully eject. So one of the balls got stuck between the bumper and the gutter. So because, and this is probably because we're British and it doesn't matter in other countries, but because we're British, we respect the sanctity of the line.
Of course
no
you
one,
do.
You can't
and no
cross
one ever,
it.
No. No one ever, for no reason whatsoever.
That's
it's not
lies.
Archery. You know, it's not axe throwing. Nothing bad's going to
shooting range.
Yeah. No one crosses the line. And so I think that if you were of an alien species and you'd understand, oh, this is, you know, I get the point. But what is the deal with the line? And the fact that
Why
we had to
just
get
go
a man
up to the pins and kick him over.
Yeah, we had a man in a suit have to come to relinquish the ball. Chris, do you know what else is different?
Was there an air hockey table? Because when I think of a bowling, 10-pin bowling, I think there's got to be an air hockey table nearby.
There was an air hockey table.
Oh, was there? No, it's you can just wear your own shoes now.
What?
Yeah.
What? Because I was about to say that one of the reasons why you don't cross the line is because it's super slippy, which I found to my own cost when I slipped and went past the line and just carried on going as a child.
Did you immediately burst into flame?
He's lasered
no friction
down.
Well, you can just wear your own shoes. That just makes a whole mockery of the history of bowling.
I remember when I was a kid that you'd go to bowling, all the lights were on. It's a serious sport. You spent a while picking your ball off the rack at the back.
Yeah, because you'd go and find your own ball and you'd bring it over to play and then you'd take it back at the end.
Yep. And the line was sacrosanct to the point where I think you could void your game if you went over it.
It's now the Wild West.
Because I didn't see you until Saturday afternoon.
So yeah, you came on the Saturday. Unfortunately, Pete wasn't able to make it as well. The curse almost hit, I think, a week before he was due to, we were all meeting up, the regular infamous news article of the latest in Arctic storms about to hit Bristol landed. So we all thought, okay, here we go again. But thankfully, that didn't land. Unfortunately, Pete did come down with some flu-like symptoms. So Pete, hope you're feeling better. Get well soon. So yeah, he wasn't able to make it. So just on the Friday, it was just Sam, just me and Sam. So when that happened, I kind of scanned the World Wide Web and find like what kind of two-player kind of co-op games are there that I could play. Anything I've not heard of, anything we've not played before. And I came across a game that I'd never heard before. And Sam had never heard of it either, called Escape Academy. Have you heard of this, Chris?
I have. So I came across this a few months ago because I was getting a real hankering for like those escape room games. So Pete and I have played a lot of those The Room games, which I typically would take on holiday with me on my mobile phone. Like, you're on a plane, when you're waiting. Those little escape room games are really, really lovely. And this looked incredible. It looked like almost like one of those classic escape rooms, but crossed with like The Witness. And then I just forgot about it. So I'm really, really curious to know what you made of this, really, because I'm itching to play a new escape room game, really.
So yes, this is Escape Academy from Coin Crew Games, and like we've got a history, I think some of us more than others, of kind of escape rooms in various guises. Obviously, Sam, you have a long history of doing kind of physical escape rooms, but as you mentioned there, we played video games in the past, like The Room, something like The Witness. Even you could argue things like Keep Talking, Nobody Explodes. That's a similar kind of thing. As well as like your more physical board games, things like the Exit games. That's the kind of a perfect encapsulation of that. But kind of, I've never played anything quite as kind of overtly escape room as this. And the game is kind of, the concept of the game is you are a student who has joined what is basically Hogwarts for escape rooms. You're going to university that is teaching escapists how to escape, and you do that through a variety of different kind of escape rooms throughout the thing, and you're learning from different teachers in air quotes. And what starts off as thinking kind of, I don't think this is going to be very good, because they kind of put you in this really kind of dingy little escape room, which literally, I mean, I say us, took Sam about 2.5 minutes to finish, and we left and I was like, oh no, what have I gone in for here? This looked fun. Oh, what have I done? Is it just gonna be one thing, we're gonna burn through it in 20 minutes? But it's kind of designed to just introduce you to mechanics, and then it kind of kicks into gear a bit more. And what's actually really nice about it is, more than any other video game I've played, including like the games like The Room and stuff like that, it really, for me, encapsulates what an escape room is, the physical escape rooms that you go to and you have to solve puzzles, especially when you're working kind of cooperatively, because you do have a thing of going around a room, searching different things, finding numbers, finding codes, finding padlocks, and all these different things, and knowing that certain things are going to blend together. And it'll be, Sam might be in the corner saying, I've just found this padlock, and I've over here said, well, I've just found this code, and I'm now going to read out the code to Sam, which is exactly what happens in an escape room. I've got this over here, so let me just say it's 6923. Does that work? Yes, it does. Okay, I've got a key. Oh, there was a key over there. And it's that kind of thing. And it's really quite impressive how it manages to do that. And the puzzles, I don't know how much, I think we probably played about half of it, I think. I think we probably got about halfway through. So it's not a kind of a long game. I think kind of, if you go to howlongtobeat.com, it's about 5 hours kind of in total.
So roughly 5 escape rooms.
I think there's 10 escape rooms, I think.
Oh, okay.
So it's a decent, you do get kind of a decent amount of gameplay from it. Each of the escape rooms have a time limit, so you still have that element of urgency that you get from an escape room. And there is a kind of an ongoing narrative that is building, and some of it goes wild as to kind of, where are you going with this? Like, you, at one point you're kind of basically fighting terrorists, and it's like, this is very strange. But you do get kind of progressively more difficult and more complex puzzles. And there is always that thing, you know, when we've been in escape rooms before and you can't figure something out, and then something clicks and you figure it out, and you're like, of course, this is, I can't believe I didn't see this before. It does that. So there are certain times where it has got us to look at certain objects, and you can be looking at them for ages and can't figure out what it is, and then you look at it from a slightly different angle and, oh, something clicks, and it's done. And it captures that element from that escape room experience beautifully.
Yeah, and the setting is actually, on reflection, quite clever, because most of the video game space, and indeed most of the board game escape room space, has tried to actually provide an experience which is escape room like, because I think they see that this is a space either that is fueled by your imagination, so therefore like the Unlock games or the escape games from Cosmos, or they're a video game, so why do we need to do the ridiculous things like locks, and why the process of having puzzles evident in such an overt fashion doesn't feel right in a really in a video game, really, when you can have it, the setting anywhere you want. As Dan said, you could just do it like a keep talking and nobody explodes, where you just hide the puzzles within something else, because you can do anything you want with a video game. However, in a physical location, it's a lot more limited to budget and resources and layout and actually getting people through. However, because this is set at an escape academy where they are teaching people how to escape, they can really embrace all the tropes and the trappings of a modern physical escape room. You encounter the same types of locks, the same types of codes, the same types of patterns of play, as Dan was saying. So for someone like me, who's 37, nearly 38 years unbeaten in an escape room, it was all very familiar. This was why, like, we solved the first few rooms in like under a minute, because it was just like, right, I picked up a blue cup. That's obviously something. And I've picked up another big paper, piece of paper that has a blue splodge, a green splodge, and a red splodge, and a picture of a cup. Like, I know what I'm going to be doing here. I'm already aware, like, the language of the escape room is the same. But what Escape Academy sort of layers on top of that is that you'll be solving those puzzles, for example, but rather than being in a static room, you're in a room that's filling with water. You're in a hostage crisis. So it's able to marry up both things, like the familiarity of being in an escape room, but on top of that, it's able to give it a bit of that video game oomph. It's a bit like what I would imagine an escape room in VR might feel like.
This is a question I want to ask you, Sam, was because you're very proud of this run that you've had, where you've mm-hmm. never ever been locked inside an escape room.
Nope.
Like, does this count for you? Because like I can imagine, joking aside, like when I play games like The Room, or you know, other ones that are a little bit longer, which are a little bit more complicated, like Agent A, for example, which are almost like point and click adventures. I don't think about them in the same breath as I would think about, you know, going into Manchester or Liverpool and playing an escape room live. Is this something that can walk between both worlds? Is this a bridging point?
A little bit. I wouldn't say 100%, but there was definitely moments where I felt the same frustrations and the same satisfaction that I do from doing escape room games, and that centered mainly around on getting hints. Now, usually what frustrates me most about escape rooms is not knowing how long you've got to really advance through the game. Does that make sense? It's like, like me and Dan were stuck on a puzzle for about 5 or 10 minutes. Now, do you ask for a clue, or do you spend another 5 minutes? And we probably would have cracked it after another 5 minutes, but not knowing what was on the horizon and not knowing how long the next sort of part of the puzzle is going to take. So you ask for a clue because you kind of just want to get through things, and then you get to the other side and realize, oh, there was only one puzzle and we've done it in a few minutes, and then we get out. And that happened a few times with me and Dan. Like, sometimes we kind of just risked it. Like, the risk of doing that is less in Escape Academy because, you know, you've paid your money up front, you're not actually locked in a physical room, you can kind of just bumble about a bit. But there was also the very real frustration that I have of, well, we've asked for a clue, and in reality, we could have actually probably spent more time and just figured that out for ourselves.
Dan, you mentioned the fact that Sam was looking at one bit of the room and you're looking at another. What, are you playing this split screen or on separate devices? How does that work?
So we were playing split screen because we were playing on the PlayStation.
Right.
So we were literally sat next to each other on a sofa playing split screen, so working as a team. But all the different rooms have great kind of variety, so sometimes they are just based in one room, whereas often, as is the case, anyone who's done a physical escape room, sometimes there are other hidden rooms, or there's different sections to different rooms that you have to maybe open a door and unlock a door. So once you're into that, there is very much a space where kind of Sam's in one area, I'm in another area, and all these things can link into each other. So there is an element of, I think there were at times like we would have perhaps raised our voices, because within the game sense, we're far away, but we're actually sat next to each other on the sofa. So he's kind of like, oh, I've got this. And like, because I'm now having to run over to Sam, but actually I'm sat next to him. So there's kind of that kind of contradiction there. But it is a really nice, the fact that it just has this kind of split screen. And you do, as well as case, you're just kind of focusing on Euro. So you know what you're looking at. And you can just hear Sam mentions, I'll just hear Sam mention something, which then tracks something for me. And he mentions, oh, there's a thing here with red, yellow, green splodges on it. I'm like, in that room, there's some red, yellow, and green paint. Oh, I'll go and have a look. I'm not sure. I'll probably check how many players it is. So I don't know if it would work for more than two. I think it's just two players.
Oh, I'll, when Pete's voice is returned, I'll try and convince him to play it with me.
It's so good in terms of recreating that experience that I was kind of almost upset that Dan had introduced me to it, because it's kind of the perfect thing that I'd like to play with my wife. As another big fan of escape room games, I know that she would really like, I think she'd get a lot from the experience, because a lot of it would be very, very familiar to her. I think the one thing we never really understood about the game is how it, because we never needed to experience it, was how it handled not actually passing through a room. And that'd be something that'd be quite interesting to see what would happen, because how the game is structured is you need to get all 10 of these badges to pass the academy. And you get the badges from completing rooms. But if you don't complete the room, then you've got to do the whole room again. And
you know, it kind of feels a bit... Then.
And yeah, absolutely. You know all the answers. So what's the point? So the actual tension that you get from seeing the clock run down is not, oh, we need to escape. It's not really a narrative tension. It's more of a, I just don't want to waste my time.
Right.
Basically. But having said all that, there is a ton of DLC. I mean, you cannot move for DLC for
it keeps trying to get you to buy DLC.
But I was looking on the Switch for about £25 as of recording. You can get everything.
Wow.
Yeah, that's, I think, decent, that, I think when I bought it, the game, the core game, was, I think, £16 on PlayStation. But I did also see a season pass for DLC was like another £12. So that kind of chimes in at a similar kind of price point to what you're seeing there. But yeah, you can absolutely see why DLC would work so well with this, because you can just drop in, okay, here's another set of rooms in this different environment. At one point I was worried it was going to turn, there were going to be open world elements, because it gives you like this big world map. I'm like, oh god, not this again. But it doesn't do that.
Like, it's
all these different areas where you can go, where there are the different kind of different rooms that you need to complete. But yeah, it's perfectly suited to that kind of environment of, you know what, I'm going to go and just get a bit of DLC for that. And that's not, I'm someone who doesn't spend money on DLC, really. But I can absolutely imagine, kind of, if, like, as Sam is playing with his wife, if I was playing the game with my wife at home, I can absolutely see a reason. Like, you know what, let's spend an extra tenner and let's just get some more of them, because we had a great time for, and we don't have to spend a long time playing it. You can do it over a relatively short period, or just kind of over a few sessions.
That's awesome. Well, I'm definitely gonna have to check this out. So Pete, say something if you don't want to join me at all. Okay, we're doing it. Thanks, Pete.
That's great. That answers Pete. Thank you, Pete. It made Chris's day.
So obviously when I turned up, the party properly started.
The party really began.
Yeah.
It really began.
I released the balloons, really struggling. The music kicked off, I turned all my party lights on, you know.
We did our duty and due diligence, Sam, of introducing another person to the Blitz.
Oh yes, we have indoctrinated. We have introduced.
Go on.
It's all staying in.
We have indoctrinated. Indoctrinated?
Yeah.
Indoctored. Yeah.
Indoctrinated. Yeah.
Yeah.
Indoctrinated Dan into the welcoming bosom of the Blitz. And it was, I have to say this, it was one of the best games of Dutch Blitz I have played
since playing.
To give you a bit of the synopsis of it. So to win Dutch Blitz, you need to get 75 points. At one point, Dan had 71.
73.
73, sorry. At one point, Dan had 73. Chris had 45 or something. And I had 57. And within a matter of games, I finished with 80, Dan finished on 79, Chris was still at 46. But it was just one of the most bonkers,
brilliant
swings in a game. And it just like typifies like how brilliant Dutch Blitz is, that you can be riding high for so long, but it just doesn't take much to really pull you down and give you a quite a humbling experience.
I know every, for the last three episodes of this podcast, listener, we've spoken about
we've
Dutch Blitz.
But
it's a game,
and every time
keeps...
I buy a new deck.
But it's a game that keeps revealing itself. I was thinking about this today. I was walking back from the shops and I was thinking about Dutch Blitz because it's an amazing game.
Yeah, and why wouldn't you?
There's a friend of ours, Sam, that occasionally I play board games with. And him and I messaged each other once, and I was going to go around. I was going around there to play games, and I said, "Oh, let's play Brass. I've not played Brass in a while." And they were like, "Just to warn you, you may not enjoy it because I've played so many games of Brass now that I genuinely don't think you're going to beat me. I know the game inside out. I know how it works. It's not going to be fun for you."
What a lovely guy.
But no. But like,
trust
you know,
me,
it is lovely.
I won't make this fun.
We were talking about pool, for example, and the people who just will just wipe the floor with you. The thing I love about Dutch Blitz is it doesn't matter, really speaking, how long you've played it for. Because of those swings, anyone can claim it. Even at the last moment, you can claim it. It's the luck of the cards. Yes, there's a degree of skill in terms of knowing when to ladder and stuff like that. But what I love about it is if you haven't played in a while, or you've come into a room full of people who are seasoned players at this, you've got just as much as an edge as everyone else around that table, really. Mm-hmm. That's what I love about this game. But then, and we played this next game a few times, actually. We read a book together, pretty much.
Pretty much.
We played a game in a book.
Really,
an actual
small
book that you
kind
open.
Of indie book, I think. Independent book. I don't think it's...
Yeah, the little book that could.
This was Lord of the Rings adventure book game.
Now, we've played a lot of Lord of the Rings games, Sam.
Even one very recently.
Yeah.
Called Lord of the Rings Adventure to Mount Doom. And if, like me, currently, you've got them both open on tabs on BGG and you cycle through the two of them, the artwork is very similar between them. It's actually quite funny. But they play very differently in terms of games, whereas Lord of the Rings Adventure to Mount Doom was it's a strikingly beautiful, how would you describe it, like a sort of like a dice management experience where you try and get Frodo and the Fellowship all the way from the Shire up to Mount Doom. The adventure book game is a completely different prospect in terms of that Lord of the Rings experience. First of all, it's from Ravensburger. Adventure to Mount Doom is from Cosmos, designed by Jay Little, Ryan Miller and Marcus Ross. This is the third of an adventure book game series that has come from Ravensburger. So they've released one with Wizard of Oz, and they've released one with the Princess Bride, and this is the third one in the series, Lord of the Rings adventure book game, which annoyed me slightly because when Ravensburger were kind enough to send me a copy for us to speak about on the show, it's got a 3 on the spine, and I was immediately like, here we go. I can't have something with a 3 on. It's like when you get a graphic novel, but it's like the fourth one.
That's what my brother did for me. He brought me a couple of Christmases ago, Dan. My brother bought me. I'd read Batman Eternal Volume 1. My brother bought me for Christmas Volume 3. So and then the Christmas afterwards, he bought me Volume 2. So just sat there for a year. It was lovely to get the gift, but you know, I assumed he'd know how numbers worked.
So the hook with the adventure book games is that instead of having a board like Adventure to Mount Doom, and you know, I'm kind of not trying to compare the two games much together because I think they're entirely different prospects, and I think they're doing very, very different things with the Lord of the Rings franchise, but it's the most recent example that I've got. However, unlike a board that you get with Adventure to Mount Doom, the adventure book game, the board is a book that you play on. So each chapter of the book presents a different play state, presents a different part of the Lord of the Rings story as we know and love it, but also presents a new challenge for you to get through as teammates. the actual mechanics of the game stay relatively similar from one chapter to the next. You will have specific members of the Fellowship that you are in control of. You can move them for a free cost at the start of your turn. You can also discard cards to move them a little bit more if you want. You then discard cards from your hands that have certain symbols on to, say, for example, defeat enemies, or to cross the Bridge of Khazad-dûm, or, for example, to quieten down the angry men in the Council of Elrond. So you're always constantly, the main mechanic of the game is balancing the cards you have in your hand with the cards you need to complete certain objectives and to do certain things on each of the chapters of the game. After we played the first chapter, I was very skeptical about what this game would actually offer in terms of a broader experience. Because the first chapter was just about avoiding the Black Riders or the Ringwraiths as they go on their merry little way, as we're trying to make our way to Bree and then make our way to Weathertop and escape with the ring. And it was very much a game about basically just discarding cards and controlling movement in order to manipulate the board in certain ways. So when we have characters in certain positions, say, for example, all of the Fellowship on a location defined as Bree, if we discard this card, this card, and this card, we've completed that chapter. Well done, us. And I thought, this is interesting, but is it just going to be this for seven other chapters? Turns out, it's not. And it immediately with the next chapter goes, don't worry, hold our beer. This game is going to be doing something absolutely buck wild. Because the next chapter focuses on the Council of Elrond. And it is diplomacy in action. And there's no combat. There's no direct sort of interaction with the enemy. Instead, you're using those same cards and those same actions and those same movement and completing chapters and meeting objectives to enact the will of the council and bring the Fellowship together. And I just found that a complete magical 180. Yeah,
that's the tipping point.
Yeah, it was massively the tipping point for me. Because whereas Adventure to Mount Doom is pretty much the same game throughout until you get to Mount Doom and it slightly changes, it's still very much just protecting Frodo and the party from one specific scene or area from the Fellowship. Here, in the Adventure Book series, they're able to focus on a lot more of the actual nuances between what actually happens on some of the main focuses of the story, but use the mechanics to do a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of moving that story along. And I was very, very impressed.
Yeah, I've played a lot of Lord of the Rings games.
Yes.
I own Lord of the Rings Confrontation, which Dan bought me. Mm-hmm. I own War of the Ring, all of it, apart from the latest expansion. Through you, Sam, I've played a lot of Lord of the Rings games. I even own Journeys in Middle-earth, which I bought at Aircon last year. Never have I ever experienced the longest chapter in the Fellowship of the Ring, which is the Council of Elrond. No game touches it. Even War of the Ring, which is the biggest of the lot, which actually, thinking about it, that would be an amazing little expansion to have for that game, which would change the setup. That'd be such an elegant way of doing it. Nobody has touched that chapter. And to actually have that kind of played out in a logical manner was actually really breathtaking. It made me kind of want for them in the subsequent chapters, which we've only played, I think, one after that, which was the Mines of Moria, for them to actually deliberately focus on the bits of this overly gamified and adapted text, but to focus on the bits that have not been looked at and gamifying those. That's kind of what I'd kind of look for it, really. So it'd be a very, very much a kind of a complementary title that is tackling the subject matter that no one else will do with this IP.
Hmm. I think for me, the biggest thing that I took away from it was just, because obviously it's looking at all these different areas and treating them differently. And the game, I mean, I would disagree slightly with you, Sam. I do feel like it, the gameplay is changing. The kind of, yes, you're doing the same movements, but it feels completely different when you're in different scenarios. So yeah. To touch on the kind of the third chapter we did, which was Mines of Moria, that's the first one, because what we found was we played through the first one, like, oh, that's really interesting. You do have a sense of escape because they're escaping and you're trying to slip behind into love. There is a lovely sense of kind of just slipping behind the Black Riders as they've gone past you. You can go behind them. And then kind of looking at diplomacy, and that's a really kind of intricate way of doing it. And we started thinking, like, well, how are they going to use these mechanics to deal with combat? Because it didn't feel like it would go particularly well with combat. So when the next one came along, which is Mines of Moria, and obviously it's around the Bridge at Khazad Dûm, kind of the battle with the troll in the kind of in the mines, and also the Balrog. Obviously, they start to bring in combat with this, and the way they do it is they kind of split out some of the characters. So you have Gandalf fighting with the Balrog throughout the kind of the chapter, and there's a constant back and forth with him. It's not just a case of, oh, Gandalf has killed the Balrog, let's move on. The Balrog can't be killed, but there is a constant back and forth that you have to constantly be monitoring, which is a really lovely kind of dynamic to have. If you want to try and kind of damage the troll, you can't just have someone go up and damage it. You have to kind of flank him with two characters, two of the warrior characters, of Aragorn or Legolas or Gimli. They can't do it by themselves in the same way that in the narrative they wouldn't be able to just do it by themselves. They have to work together. They have to defeat goblins first. And so all of this stuff, again, the core instructions that you're giving to the characters to move, so one character moves one place and then I'm going to swap a card, I'm going to play a card, I'm going to discard a card, none of that changes. However, what you're actually doing and the way those mechanics kind of bend to the will of what that chapter demands is incredible, that you feel like by doing the exact same thing you've had three completely different experiences, but actually what you've been doing hasn't changed. And I think that's really really impressive.
Well, I actually want to just commend both Sam and Ravensburger for pulling off the most incredible thing. You got Dan Frost to play deck builder.
Yeah, you lured me into it. You got very excited about a third of the way into the game when you realized it was a deck building game. And you got very excited about it. It's a very minor deck building game.
It's very, very minimal deck
building. Yeah, it is minimal deck building game. But Dan, you have got a very, very good board gaming brain. Like, you have a very good logical brain. It was actually really good fun playing with you because you have a very good strategic mind. You love the books. You love the source material. You and I have had many great Middle-earth experiences together. Like, did those two marry well enough for you? That kind of strategic side of your brain and your love of this kind of source material, do they intertwine nicely for you as a complete package?
Now, this isn't me kind of poo-pooing the deck building element of the game, because I love how it blended into the narrative. I think it worked beautifully well. The only bit of it that felt a little bit gamey, and obviously it's all the game, but the bit that felt a little bit gamey were these special cards that came out that suddenly, oh, if you play this card, you can use the ring and not become corrupted by it for a turn. Or you can use this and you'll get this. And those are nice cards and they're nice narratively linked. So one links to Arwen's love, another links to the locks from Galadriel and all that. So it's all very narratively tied in. But those did start to feel a little bit gamey, whereas the other ones are kind of just you're playing cards, which obviously is still all of that. I didn't object to it, but if I'm looking at it as a entirety, those were elements that kind of didn't click in the same way that the way the rest of it was constructed did.
How would you then fuse in those crucial parts of the Lord of the Rings story and create that sense of a developing experience? Because how the special cards work is that when you complete a certain challenge, you can draw from this deck, which will give you a special card, which might be the Eagles, or it might be Galadriel's Mirror, or something, something, something. And it goes into the discard pile, so they don't become active until the next time you have to shuffle through the story deck, which might not be until the next chapter. So for me, it worked really well because it gave a sense of growth and development within the Fellowship. So I don't know how else you would synthesize that same experience with
I'd absolutely agree. I don't think there is necessarily a better way of doing it. And I think because obviously we played three rounds, I think we introduced perhaps three cards over the course of our entire play session. But because of that, I don't think we're ever in a situation where we were playing these cards and we were able to utilize the powers. We maybe use them once or twice, but we never really were able to use them to the extent that it was having an effect on our gameplay. Like, often it was the card that we would trade between each other because we couldn't use it at that time. But I needed a sword card from you, Sam, but I had the card for kind of Galadriel's hair, so I would trade that because I had no use of it. And that's kind of, we never actually got to the kind of the nitty-gritty of using those. And obviously that does build into the kind of the deck building thing, and that kind of goes over my head. But I don't know of another way of doing it. And you are absolutely right that it does provide an element of development and an element of growth into the game, that as the game builds, you then start to obviously have these. Were the special cards in order, or are they shuffled? Because obviously the ones we looked at were kind of Arwen, Galadriel, and I think Bilbo's journal as well. So these were all fellowship based items, and we were the chapters we did were all part of the Fellowship of the Ring kind of novel. Were they shuffled, or were they in some kind of order?
No, they're all shuffled, so it's completely random. We could have got the Eagles as a first sort of special card, but then I think that the adventure book series, I think as a whole, is also targeting a very different market, whereas Adventures to Mount Doom was very, very, like, the cards you experience and the cards you get access to are very controlled. You do not get access to a character that, so the Fellowship meet at Helm's Deep, until you get to the Helm's Deep chapter. Like, it's very, very prescriptive. It's very, very determined about telling the story in a very specific way, which is married up with the art of Adventure to Mount Doom, because the art style is bespoke. It's based more on the literal interpretation of the Lord of the Rings rather than the filmic. However, the adventure book series is very, very much based on Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings. The art and the style of it is all based on that property, like New Line Cinema, accredited as part of the sort of the licensee holders of this property. Like, some of the images are given, it looks like they've been run past the Van Gogh filter on Google Photos. Like, so it's not as egregious as, say, in The Expanse, where they've literally just, it looks like they've just screenshotted elements of the TV series, albeit a very good game, just terrible art. Here there is at least some treatment on it, so it doesn't make you feel like you're playing a direct board game inspired by the movie. But I feel that's why they can kind of get away with introducing the Eagles during the bridge of Khazad Dûm, because people playing it will be very, very familiar with the Eagles, and maybe they're not as fussed with the linearity of the tale. They just want to play a Lord of the Rings game because that's what they've experienced from watching the movie. I don't know. I'm just hypothesizing. But it does highlight a point about the two different games. Is one is very, very much focused on providing a very, very linear, and as the books tell its story, the other one isn't. And I think there's positives and negatives for both in terms of gameplay.
Yeah, and both are family weight, aren't they, as well? It should be said.
Yeah, absolutely.
And both are absolutely cooperative.
Yes, I think Adventures to Mount Doom is probably more suited to younger players because the dice roll from whence you assign moves to the characters, because that's a public thing, then parents can get a bit more involved in terms of where the assigning should be placed, and it feels a bit more natural to do things as a group. Whereas because you're doing things out from a deck of hands in the adventure book series, I think that's probably more appropriate for an older family, where there's going to be less of, well, just let me look at your deck of cards and just give me that. There's a bit more of an independent process that each player has got to do. But weighting wise, it's very much still a brilliant family experience. Even if third chapter does have a bit of a difficulty curve.
Yeah. So Ravensburger have done three of these, as we know. They've done Princess Bride.
I know what question you're going to ask, and the answer is Count of Monte Cristo.
Thank you. Yes. So, Dan, what's your answer? What if they had to do? Because bearing in mind, these have been all so far actually board games based on film adaptations of books.
Books.
So, yeah. Sam has thrown the Count of Monte Cristo into it.
I'd change my mind. I'd go with, apparently, the most recent adaptation of The Three Musketeers
Yes. Is
really, really good.
I've heard that too.
And I've always attested that The Three Musketeers would actually make a really good video game. Because it's all very much like, and then D'Artagnan did this. And then D'Artagnan had to go on this mission with The Three Musketeers.
Yeah. And also as a kind of cooperative experience, yes. That would work well as well, I think, definitely.
Absolutely.
Dan, a book adaptation.
Made
into a film that has now become this board game.
Turn it back into a board game. Turn it back into a book.
I mean, Dune is the obvious option. Also thinking Moby Dick.
Oh, wow.
But my first thought before you said book adaptation, my first thought was Back to the Future. That was my first thing. You said book adaptation. I can't use that. So maybe Moby Dick.
I like the idea that in Back to the Future, you start in the middle of the book.
I like the idea with the Dune one. You can make it pop up and have a big, like, sandworm.
with your hand through it, controlling it.
Mine would be, thanks for asking, the 2006 adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. I would absolutely love that. Because I was in a board game shop the other day and they had... Do you remember playing Marrying Mr. Darcy years ago, Sam?
I played that with
Pete and Alex. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely loved that game. I nearly picked it up, but it was like £25. But it made me realise actually how much I love a good old period drama. So I think Pride and Prejudice. I would like it also if the exact same mechanics from this Lord of the Rings game just had a completely different skin. It was still... Pride, you know, still the Lord of the Rings mechanics, but in Pride and Prejudice world. So I don't know what the Balrog would represent.
But I can see that in terms of, especially the Council of Elrond chapter.
Oh,
being a courtly dance.
That's it. Yeah, Elrond's taking a turn around the room.
I was thinking the Gandalf Balrog being a courtly dance as they move back and forth.
Oh, that could be literally Lizzie and Mr. Darcy.
Okay. Ravensburger, if you're listening. We charge a very, very...
I don't think we can claim anything for just saying Pride and Prejudice.
We charge a very, very low fee for these wonderful ideas. Just saying.
Yeah, in fact, we will pay you.
No, Chris, don't say that, Chris. That's not how it works.
Dan, I want you to picture something.
Okay. I'll close my eyes.
I don't know what's happened, but for some reason, Sam and I are on a cliff top.
Okay.
It's so we're facing each other. We're some distance apart. The wind is howling. We're lit solely by the moon, and we both each have a samurai sword, and we're poised, ready. We're holding it, pointing upwards, and there's this tension that's palpable. Each of us is waiting for the other to strike. We're trying to work out, okay, based on the way they're standing, how they're looking, what's going to be their opening move. That is essentially the kind of tension I'm talking about here. I'm talking about Kiriai the Jewel, which is a game that I pre-ordered some time ago, ever since I watched a video, I think it was from Gen Con last year, I think, the Dicebreaker team were just reeling off a list of games they'd been playing at this convention, like, repeatedly. And they said, yeah, this one, Kiriai. And I looked it up, and it sounded amazing. So this came out last year. It comes from Kami Bayashi, who's based in Yokohama in Japan, who was an advertising agent. And then in 1999, they created their own board gaming company, Titan Heads. And this was originally put out, publisher was Mugen Games, and then Lucky Duck have taken it on as well and distributed it widely. And it's a head-to-head game, obviously, two samurai, where everything takes place through cards. And this kind of goes into one of Sam's categories of cloth games to a degree, where... To a degree?
No.
Okay, maybe it doesn't. No.
Is there a cloth involved?
Well, there is.
No.
But I suppose really thinking about it, Sam's right. It's in the same way that there's a kind of a cloth in Love Letter in terms of the bag.
Yes.
So you've kind of got this, it's modelled on an old Edo Japan kind of purse. So you unfurl this kind of cloth bag and it has inside it this little premise there that's written there in this yellow font that kind of stands out against this black kind of material. And it says, two samurai face each other on the cliff's edge. Cloudy skies darken the night. The moon breaks through as they strike. This is Kiri Ai, the jewel. And you take out 16 cards, and that's the whole game, 16 cards. Now, I know what you're thinking. What are these cards, Chris? Well, two of them are each a samurai warrior. And you flip them over. On one side, they're there at full health. You flip them over again. The other side, you can see there's a blade that's cut them in half. They're at half health. Because really, in this game, two hits and you're out. That's it. That's why it's a fairly quick game. And I say fairly, I'll come back to this in a bit. So just picture me and Sam. Picture me. Sam, what are you wearing in this scenario?
A sarong.
Yeah, very clever. He's trying to psych me out.
What are you wearing? What are you wearing, Chris? It's important.
Nothing but one of those hats.
What hats?
You know, the one that Mizu wears in Blue Eye Samurai.
All right, okay. Straw hats.
Yeah, and I am blue-eyed as well, so...
Okay, I have to say, you've painted a very evocative image. That evocative image is being affected by the outfits you've chosen. So I've got Sam wearing nothing but a sarong and then Chris wearing nothing but a straw hat. Suddenly, it's less... The silhouettes you're producing are more questionable than they once were.
Two cards then, one warrior each. Another card are battleground. And there's a single line that runs along the middle of it with little dots on it. Sam, Arai, and myself start at opposite edges of it. We just slot our cards onto it at an angle, and it slots in. It looks very, very nice. And then we are each dealt out a hand of cards. And these cards that we have in our hand are either movement or attack, or a couple of them are both. You know, so when we play a card, they'll determine whether we move forwards and whether we attack, and where we attack as a consequence. And then there are these three other cards which are off to the side. They're shuffled. And we each get one. And one's just removed from the game entirely. These are our special attack cards. And they're kind of one and done. So on our go, we each play two cards in front of us. And then we reveal them simultaneously. One card after another. So Sam and I both reveal our first card at the same time. And oh, Sam's moving. I'm attacking. So movement cards are always resolved first. And oh, Sam's doing that. Okay, well, if he's doing that, his second card might be this. You start thinking. And yes, it says on BGG that this is a 5 to 10 minute game. And yes, you could play it like that. You could play it like a game of Snap, say, for example. But the joy for this for me, and maybe Sam, you can attest to this, I don't know, is that kind of slight of rock, paper, scissors style where, okay, they played stone last time. They can't play it again. Surely? Are they double bluffing me? Are they triple bluffing me? I don't know. I'm looking at Sam's eyes, but all I can see is a sarong. What is Sam doing?
As you were describing that, the thought that came to my mind was kind of rock, paper, scissors, that kind of like 1, 2, 3 reveal. 1, 2, 3 reveal. And I think we play lots of different games around kind of strategy and stuff like that, and sometimes some of the most fun things about those games, and I go back to something we talked about around Twilight Imperium, is that reveal of you and trying to understand what someone's plan is. They've got a plan and they're actioning it, and it's quite slow moving. And obviously this is massively condensed, but I can see that kind of element here of, okay, they made that move. Okay, what are they going to do next? How can I combat that? Do I need to try and combat that, or am I just going to focus in on what I'm going to do instead and just kind of balance that out? And so, yeah, I can. If you lean into the themes of it, I can absolutely see that it's not just going to be okay. 1, 2, 3, go. 1, 2, 3, go. 1, 2, 3, go. And that's no. Okay. By leaning into that theme, it is a lot more kind of slow paced. Is that? Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, this probably, you know, there's, you only have to hit your opponent twice. And I think both games, when me and Chris played it, lasted about 20 minutes each. And mostly that was just time spent really trying to just work out the other opponent, or it was that build-up of... It's very, very easy in this game for your moves to go awry, but there's not much of a punishment for it, which is good. So very, very... What would actually happen commonly is that me and Chris would basically advance forward too far, essentially passing each other, and then attack. And then we'd have to work our way back to then get into a position where we could attack again. So in the same way that if you've seen, you know, samurai duels depicted in the past, that same sort of method of waiting, and then attack. The game does a very good job of simulating that kind of experience and making it feel like every movement counts, but only up to a point, because there's actually some relief when you're both gone beyond each other.
Yeah.
Because you know you can't attack, so you've got there's a bit of a stay of execution there where you can kind of, right, work your way back, right, okay, we're face to face again now, and now the game, the tension starts ramping up and up and up and up again. So the playing of the game, that really does lengthen it, because more often than not, you are going to be moving beyond each other and back again, moving beyond each other and back again, or one of you taking a further step back and one of you encroaching, and then quickly moving back because they know the other one's going to move forward again. There's this wonderful cat and mouse style of play to it, which really lends itself to the overall theme and the drama of the piece.
An interesting thing for me is the fact that with the rock, paper, scissors thing, there are certain things that you can kind of look at as tells, really, that can, I suppose, really guide you a little bit. And that's obviously depending on how much your opposing player wants to bluff you. So there's a little thing like stances. So certain cards can only be played if you happen to be in the right stance. So, for example, Sam may play a card and he's switching from heaven stance with his sword pointing upwards to earth stance with his sword pointing below. And I don't know if he's bluffing, but equally also it might tell me that, okay, he's thinking about going for this kind of move, because for an earth stance move, typically, you're not really being able to swing your blade very far ahead of you. That tells me that he's planning at some point in the future to move very close to me. He's assuming that I'm going to move very close to him. Because there could be a situation where both of us actually attack each other at the same time and we both get hit as a consequence. Secondly, also, is it has this very neat thing where once you play both your cards, the first card we played returns to our hand, whereas the second card is kind of momentarily set aside for a round. So if Sam has played, for example, a card where he strikes two ahead of him, I know that he's not going to be in a position to do that for this next round, because that card is exhausted for this round, say, for example. And that just means there's just enough of you for you there to feel that actually you've got a little bit of a handle on what's going on.
Yeah.
And looking at obviously when we were talking about the Lord of the Rings game, like one thing that I think worked for us in terms of the building the narrative was like a lot of the artwork that was used, kind of beautifully illustrated. Looking at Kiriai, the duel, I mean, obviously it's kind of the other end of the spectrum here. It's quite abstract and very minimalist. Yeah. And obviously like your core cards are kind of like just solid block of red with like silhouettes of a samurai on them.
Yeah.
Like, how does that kind of minimalist kind of abstract imagery, does that affect how you can get immersed with the kind of the themes, or is it the other, does it actually help with that because of the nature of it, because it's a little bit different and it's actually not too kind of overbearing, and kind of the illustrations too, which it actually helps the kind of simplicity of the game?
Interestingly, I think that the art goes a long way to telling that story. Another designer and another publisher would, I feel, sacrifice that art to enhance the gameplay slightly. So I think in another designer's hands or another publisher's hands, I think there would have been more text on the cards that would have spelt out, you move forward two spaces and attack in this stance, this space, and attack space B, or whatever. However, there is a complete lack of instruction on the cards, so there's so much room for this minimalistic and very striking artistic impression of what this jewel looks like, which is where I sort of struggled most with, because you do spend quite a lot of the early game trying to interpret the art and really get your head around what it's telling you and what it's informing you as a player in terms of what's going to happen next, which means that when cards are revealed, you do spend the first few moments just figuring out, okay, that's there, and if I squint a little bit, oh yeah, I can see that's, yeah, you're hitting that. After a while, that kind of ebbs away, yeah. And the story just kind of flows out of it. But the art style, especially in the early time that you're playing, it doesn't really help. But I feel like it's such a strong decision,
yeah,
to stick with it, that it in the end, once you get used to it and once you learn the game via playing rather than learning via reading on a card what each of them does, then it really, really helps tell the story. Like I think it was such a brave decision to give it that style of art, because it is not easy to read.
No, and I think actually that is the kind of USP of Kamibayashi, that they pride themselves on designing games that have a minimalist and clean aesthetic. I think one of the benefits of this clean aesthetic, once you've kind of wrapped your head around, you know, it's the logic behind it, is that it focuses solely on you two as the players. You know, you're not thinking about this samurai as two separate avatars. You're looking at them there. You can see their pictures with their own personalities. This is me and Sam. We're dueling here right now, essentially.
Sure.
And there's something really interesting about that. You know, sometimes Sam will do something and I go, oh, I thought you were going to do here. Oh, I should have stuck to my guns. I thought you were going to move here. And it's aimed at Sam. It's not aimed at, oh, look at what they've done there. And there's something really interesting about that in a kind of head-to-head context that works. I mean, who knows? Maybe this game, if it grows in popularity, they'll reskin it as a new version. It'll have like actual physical miniatures on the board, again, running along this line. But I really love that kind of clean simplicity, where abstracts in this kind of via negativa way does really, really work and heighten the tension. And just in a few cards, there is so much happening between me and Sam in that space as we're trying to work out what the other person is going to do and when they're going to strike.
If you're interested, no one asked, what are you doing on your birthday, Sam? Well, thanks for asking, everyone.
Hey, Sam.
I'm going to... Yeah?
What are you doing for your birthday?
Oh, thanks for asking.
Please be fair, Pete was trying to ask, he just can't speak. Yeah. Sorry.
All right, fair.
Pete, yeah. Shush.
I heard a hush. I'm going to go and see Dune Part 2 at the IMAX. And yeah, I don't think my eyeballs or eardrums are completely ready for what that experience is going to be like. But I can't wait. I'm also going to go to the post office, get my hair cut, going to go for a run.
Remember to book your birthday off for next year.
Oh, yeah. First thing I do when I wake up, book birthday off for next year. Thank you very much. And it's on a Friday next year, so long weekend.
Nice.
Absolutely. But I can say that by the time you're listening to this, myself and Chris, for definites, Pete, we'll see, will be at Aircon, pressing the flesh, rolling some dice, and generally having not our flesh...
Yeah, sorry, what's going on? Sam?
Yeah, we're going to recreate that samurai battle.
Okay, unfortunately, I won't be there, but I would just, if anyone's concerned about apparently pressing the flesh, I will send Sam on strict orders to be on best behaviour.
Yeah. If you just want a sticker, then you can just get a sticker. You don't have to commit to anything. But Chris and I, and hopefully Pete... pray to the gods willing, we'll be there this year. I cannot wait for Aircon this year. It's going to be an absolute, well, it's always a blast, but I feel like this year is going to be even bigger and better, because it always tends to improve year on year. So really excited to be at aircon. So if you're listening to this while you're queuing up to get inside or browsing the bring and buy, then do look out for us on the show floor. We're going to be there every day doing an RPG, one in the mornings. We've got all our meals booked.
Yes.
Which is priority number one.
Oh,
we've got
my word, yes.
Breakfast, lunch and dinner all booked throughout the whole three days that we're
there.
We'll
be going to the Timothy Taylor pub.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. It's
have the inaugural staying tradition. In drink.
Yes, absolutely. So if you see us there, we will have stickers to give out. So do please say hello. It'll be really nice to see you if you're there. In terms of other things going on, we've got the curated pages on Board Game Geek and on Steam. So if you're at Aircon and you're like, oh my God, I don't know what to get from the bring and buy, or I don't know what to buy from the shops, then you can look on BGG at games that we've spoken about in the past and games that we recommend that would be good to play. So we've also got one of those curated pages on Steam as well, should you wish to look at video games we've also recommended, because it's been a bit... Oh, Escape Academy will be on there, but a bit board game heavy. Escape Academy has actually a pretty decent soundtrack, yeah, by the hip-hop artist Dose One, which I only became aware of now, but and actually I've been a massive fan of Dose One for ages, and I was actually quite surprised that he's doing video game soundtracks now. So that might be added very soon to one of our Spotify playlists that Chris puts together. If you'd like a link to those playlists, because they're pretty difficult to find, then just check the show notes on your podcast app of choice, or head to the website stayingandpodcast.com. There's also an email address, so if you saw us at Aircon and were a little bit starstruck and didn't want to come us over and say hello to us, but saw us and thought, wow, they look handsome, they look like they know what they're doing,
is that a sarong,
then send us an email, stayingandpod@gmail.com. and we'll be posting at various times on Instagram, stayingandpod, some of our things that we'll be doing at Aircon as well, so look out for those. But has Aircon got a beach?
I don't know, but we'll see you there, listener.
See you on the beach.
On the beach.